So as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
I wish I could tell you that the National Rifle Association was easy to get in touch with, but I could not get anybody to talk with me for this program. You see, the NRA, along with other pro-gun organizations such as Pink Pistols, refused or didn't bother to answer my requests for an interview by Facebook, by email, or by telephone. I wondered if I was trying to woo some ex-girlfriend who had filed a restraining order for bad behavior I had not remembered. But I felt that I needed to get someone from the NRA on the record. So in desperation, I called the NRA Member Services Hotline.
Thank you for calling the National Rifle Association. Due to the attacks on our Second Amendment, we are experiencing higher than usual wait time. Please hold, and the next available representative will be with you. Thank you.
Then there was a twangy loop that played over and over and over. I didn't know if I was supposed to feel like John Wayne or lust for the ideal handgun to blow my telephone to smithereens. But after 10 minutes, somebody answered.
The National Rifle Association. My name is Michelle Mavoni. May I have the last name on the account or the membership ID number, please?
Actually, I'm not a member yet. I had a couple of questions about the NRA membership. I was hoping you could help me.
Sure.
Yeah, so first of all, I just was curious about the benefits. You have this 24/7 defense of your Second Amendment freedoms. I was on hold just now for about 10 minutes, and I'm a little worried that if I need the Second Amendment defended, that I'll be on hold for quite a while. Is there a speed number for NRA members? Or?
Unfortunately, sir, we're just experiencing higher than normal call volume that we've been handling for the last month and a half, and it has been 10 minutes is surprising that you got through that quickly, because we've had people on hold as much as 2 hours during the last couple weeks. So I'm glad you got through.
Oh, so what do you attribute the rise in call volume? I mean, what specifically are people calling in for?
For new membership, sir?
Well, for new membership or anything. I mean, what is a typical call that causes someone to wait for 2 hours? I'm just curious. I'm just trying to know in case I want to be a member here.
Well, it's mostly for call volume is to sign up new members.
So you've had a rise in new membership?
Yes, sir. Did you want to join the National Rifle Association?
Well, I'm just asking some questions because I was curious about the membership. I just want to know what $35 gets me. I mean, you get the hunting cap, right?
Yes, you do receive a free gift for joining the National Rifle Association. You also receive a free magazine, which you have a choice between three, American Hunter, American Rifleman, or America's First Freedom. And all of our members receive $5,000 of accidental death or dismemberment coverage and 25 of arms care coverage, which covers firearms, bows and arrows, and air guns against theft, accidental loss, or damage. So you do not pay anything extra for the insurance or the magazine.
Which of the three magazines do you recommend?
Well, that depends. If you like knowing about more guns or guns that are coming out on the market, they have a really good article in the Rifleman magazine about how they feel, how they work, how far they shoot. They do have testers that test out new guns. They have really good articles about that. If you're interested in hunting, we do have American Hunter magazine, which goes over places to hunt, as well as techniques and guns to use on different game. We also have America's First Freedom. America's First Freedom is more political. It covers what the NRA feels that is important, and we have some really good articles in there on how we're moving forward and what we plan on doing in the future.
So this 24/7 defense of the Second Amendment freedoms, what does that mean? If I call you at 3 in the morning, am I going to get a live body?
I don't know if you would, but there is we do have everything that goes for legislation. We do have Institute of Legislative Action, which is the ILA, is our legal department, and they would be able to talk to you about anything from what the laws are again for guns and what you think should be done in the future. And they usually handle that. I just handle memberships, unfortunately.
And if someone actually had never shot a gun in her life, why would they want to join the NRA? I'm just curious.
If a person never shot a gun, why would they want to join the National Rifle Association?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I mean, if they believe in in our Second Amendment and believe they have the right, if they wanted to choose to be a part of something that protects them from ever having to choose between a gun or not having a gun, then I guess they would consider joining the National Rifle Association, or they can learn how to shoot a gun. We do have excellent educational programs. For children, for women, for men, and if they're interested in becoming educated with guns, that's all an option that they would consider.
What's the gun education for children like? I was curious about that. I may be interested in that, too.
It's called Eddie the Eagle, and it's just like we do have instructors that helped with that. Would you like me to get you transferred over there so you can ask some more questions, sir? I'm only very limited to...
Oh, yeah, no problem. I'd be happy to talk to the education department about Eddie the Eagle.
Okay, no problem. Let me go ahead and see if I can transfer you. We've had a trouble with our switchboard for the last couple days, so it is taking a little bit longer.
Okay.
I don't know if I'll be able to transfer due to the switchboard being down, but let me see if I have a number. Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I have their number as well, 800-231-0752.
Thank you very much.
No problem, sir. Anything else I can help you with today?
How does the decal look? You get the decal with the NRA membership. Can you describe that? I'm very into decals.
Okay, well, it does sound like you're questioning me about different things, sir, and I feel a little bit uncomfortable answering these questions, but if you would like to go online to our website, the store, NRA.org, you can look up the decals on there.
Okay, no problem. Thank you very much.
You have a good day, sir.
You too.
Last week, we examined the Second Amendment's history and the seductive allure of guns. This second of our two-part program will look at how gun-related crimes have affected human lives and how a flood of affordable large magazine semi-automatic pistols altered the course of American history. My name is Edward Champion, and this is Follow Your Ears. Episode 2, Guns Part 2.
And so we're waiting outside this club, and my friend Wendy rolls up. And it was like, wow, it was just like she read my mind or something, which she was known to do on occasion.
It was October 28th, 2000, 3 days before Halloween, and Cezine Kohler was out for a night on the town in Los Angeles. But what she did not know, as her best friend Wendy Soltero rolled up in her car, was that the sky was about to open up.
Out of nowhere, this car pulls up behind us, this like boxy brown kind of 70s car, and they pulled up so close to us that it made me feel really uncomfortable because it was 3 a.m. and there was nobody on the street and there was no reason for them to pull up that close to us. So I was like, all right, Wendy, like, we need to go now. Like, let's just go. And Wendy looks in the rearview mirror and she's like, oh no, it's okay. They're just dropping somebody off. And then the next thing that we knew, there was this girl in the window with a gun to Wendy's head and shouting at us for our wallets. And, Wendy was just like looking straight forward because there's a gun to her head. And I actually looked at the girl and I was begging with her to not hurt anybody, that we would give her everything that she wanted and just please not hurt anybody. And so then she points the gun at me and tells me not to look at her face. And she's saying horrible things to us. So, you know, we're all putting our heads down and I'm getting my wallet. And I've got my wallet in my hand and I'm ready to hand it to her, you know, like without looking at her face, like she said. And then all of a sudden I hear what I think is a warning shot because like my left ear, I all of a sudden I couldn't hear from my left ear. And I thought it was a warning shot, but then at the same time, like Wendy wasn't in the car anymore. And it was like the weirdest, it was such a strange feeling knowing that like that she, somehow she wasn't there. And then her body was slumping over onto me. And then the girl says to, you know, she says, I look over and she says to me, you know, I'm going to count to 3 or 10 or something. And if I don't have your wallets, the rest of you bitches are going to get it. And it was in that moment that I was like, oh my God, like she just killed Wendy. And it's so messed up. Cause you know, I had my wallet. It was there. It was ready. She just didn't give us enough time. And the friend in the back seat, she didn't even have her purse. Her purse was at the club. So I don't even know what she handed her, probably something off of the floor of Wendy's car, but she handed her something.
At what point were you aware of the gun during this altercation?
That when the girl came up to the window and she like, all of a sudden Wendy's face, like she had this very, very strange expression on her face, and she was looking straight forward. And then the girl was waving the gun around. So she took it from Wendy's head, and she waved it at the back seat. She waved it at me when I looked at her. And it was a small gun, small silver gun. And because the girl was, she was tiny. She was really, yeah, she was barely as tall as Wendy's car. I mean, she was a really little thing. Oh, it was some kind of pistol. I don't remember. I know that they talked about it when I testified, what kind of gun it was. And I saw it in a movie again, but I don't remember what it was. But it was a small gun, and they actually, they had several guns, which is what would come out later, is that they had a car full of guns. And I also don't know if they, how they had obtained them. I mean, they were gangbangers, basically. So I suspect that nothing was, purchased through legal means in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, LA's crazy with that stuff. I mean, with gun trafficking there, it's just one of the weirdest, horrible places for that.
Did you think that she would use the gun when you saw it?
You know, it was like in a dream. I mean, you know, and I saw the gun there, and I begged with her. I looked at her in the eyes, and I was just, from girl to girl, like, you know, we will do whatever you want. Just please, I beg you, don't hurt anybody. And I thought that, like, by making that human connection, that I had saved us all, you know, that we would just give her the wallets and then she would go away. But it turned out later that actually this was like her gang initiation night. So she had already like been through the whole gang rape thing, which is what, you know, in LA, the kind of Latino street gangs, like that's what happens to the women who want to be a part of it, which was weird to hear about that because that's really sad, you know. And then this night was the night that she was supposed to kill people. And so it just, yeah. And there actually what I found out again after the trial was that she had killed somebody else that night. But because they had so many guns, they threw the gun away every time they committed a crime. They were robbing people left, right, and center. I think there were about six different incidents that this couple did in the spree that night. And there was another person that they had killed, but there were no witnesses to that one. And of course, they couldn't match the gun afterwards, which was just really, you know, just so awful to think about it. And I mean, you know, after they shot Wendy and we got out of the car, it was, again, a very strange sensation in my head, this like voice screaming, hide, hide, hide. And so by the grace of the gods, there was this big white van parked across the street. And I dragged my friend who was just trying to run away somewhere else. I had dragged her across and we hid back there. And actually they came back. They came back to the car and I could hear them talking and I could hear him, the guy driving. I could hear him yelling at her, like, she saw your face or whatever. Like, I just heard him yelling at her, and then we weren't there. And so they must have figured that we ran and got help or something. And so then they just sped right off. So, I mean, they came back. They came back for us, which is, I mean, it was just such a nightmare. I mean, it was like being in hell, and all of a sudden you're like out on a Friday night, and then like the whole world is upside down.
Do you think that the fact that they had these disposable guns led them to want to come back the second time with the van? Do you think that the gun encouraged these impulses to seek revenge or to just mess around for kicks?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I don't remember how many guns that they said that they had, but they had committed, I think it was like five or six, well, four robberies, and then the two murders. Ours was a murder robbery, I guess. But they still had like four guns or something, four or five guns, several guns still in the car. And, yeah, so if you think that they're like, I mean, my God, like they went out knowing that they were going to do bad things with each of these guns, and they had enough to prepare for like the whole night, because I think their spree started around 9 or 10 and then it continued well on until like, I think 5 or 6 in the morning. And the police actually only caught them by accident as they were holding up another couple, an Asian couple. And there just happened to be police across the street. They were there for some other reason. And that's how it ended. I mean, so I could have kept going, to be honest.
I read your story the night the sky opened up, and tell us what has happened since October 28th, 2000. How has the death of Wendy at the hands of this girl affected your life?
Oh, I mean, it's basically ruined it, you know? I mean, sorry, I just need a second.
Take your time.
I mean, I used to be, a very, very strong and adventurous person, and now it's like, just living with PTSD is just the worst thing. It's just the worst thing because you can't ever escape it. And then there are like periods where you do escape it, and you're like, all right, wow, okay, it's like, I'm normal now. Like, okay, I beat this thing, and then something will happen, like Sandy Hook. And all of a sudden, it's like all the work that I've done over the last 12 years is just out the window, you know? And I can just, I'm just right back in the moment when it happened to me and Wendy. And then I can imagine what it's like for all the people, like, you know, to have this gun in your face. It's like such an awful thing. And then the survivors, you know, because then everyone has, they're like, oh, why did I survive? Why was it me? Or why not this person? And you see all the sadness, and like, it's just, It's a never-ending struggle. I know I've had to accept that it's something that I will deal with the rest of my life, and I just try to make the best of it, and I try to make art, and I try to write, and, you know, when the feeling comes up that I need to cry, like, I cry in public all the time. That's why I'm actually not that embarrassed. I'm crying right now because, you know, when it comes up, if I hold it down, then I get sick, you know, then I get, like, lung infections, I get horrible stomach things, like, you know, I have to just, the pain has to come out somehow. And every time, oh my God, I mean, every time that there's a shooting, I just lose it. And now that I'm back in America, you know, that's why I left. I lived in Europe for the last 10 years because I couldn't deal with the fear of like going into a supermarket or into a bank or being sitting in the car even, you know, because it happened in a car, and everything here is about driving and just sitting there and like, at any moment, someone could shoot you, or a gun could show up, or like a mass murder. And so I left. And when we've kind of had to come back, this was my biggest fear. And my God, I mean, and this happened to me 12 years ago, and it's still like this. And so I think about what happened at Sandy Hook and all those little kids, and like, oh my gosh, their life is going to be shaped by this, these kinds of things. I mean, And the fact is that there's no sense to it. You know, this is such senseless violence. And to have something so senseless, so meaningless, for no reason, for money, for, you know, having your face in the newspaper or whatever, to destroy lives like this, I mean, it's just, I can't even understand it. I can't even, it's just unimaginable to me, you know?
How have you dealt with the fact that guns are in our culture? You write in the piece that your father was a big fan of action movies, and mm-hmm. the gunshots from the television, you could hear them reverberating in the basement room you were in. Has it become easier at all to deal with the fact that guns are a part of Western culture, that they're not going to escape our culture anytime soon?
You know, it's really tough. Like, I will be okay with it, like, when nothing happens, but then when something happens like Sandy Hook or Aurora, then all of a sudden I can't tolerate it anymore. You know, I can't, like, just hearing the word gun, I start to like break out in hives because it just upsets me so much. And the weird thing is that, you know, I lived in Switzerland after what happened here, well, in LA, I lived in Switzerland, and you know, Switzerland, every family in Switzerland has a gun because everyone is in the army. You know, it's part of being a citizen, being a Swiss citizen, is that you have to be in the army. You spend amount of time there. So every person, basically every Swiss citizen, has their own gun. But what they do over there is that the laws are so strict. For example, unless you're on your way to your army service, your gun is not allowed to be outside of its safe box. And every person in the household who has a gun, they have their own safe box for it. If anyone is ever found with a gun from your safe box, then you are fined and the person is fined. I mean, the rules are so, so strict that, you know, there's no gun violence there. There really isn't. And I mean, now there's, you know, gangs and stuff that are starting. But even then, it's so hard to buy a gun, first of all, and then to be able to be in a position to use it, it's almost impossible. So when you think about it like that, I just don't understand what it is with this country that other places have just as many guns as we have here, and yet for some reason, people in America or these young men in America feel the need to go out and just mass slaughter people. And that's something that you really don't see very often in other countries in the West. I mean, there was that one thing in Norway, and he was, you know, like a neo-Nazi or something. But that was the first time that something had happened so massive like that in Europe in, I think, maybe ever. I don't know all the statistics, but I'm pretty sure that if it wasn't the first time, it was the first time in a very long time. So,
do you think there's a way to honor the Second Amendment? Do you feel that guns should be completely abolished, or is there a compromise in gun control that would prevent scenarios like your friend Wendy from mm-hmm. happening?
Well, a couple things. I mean, you know, we have to also be clear what the Second Amendment is. The Second Amendment isn't necessarily about gun rights. It's about the right to form a militia. So people use the Second Amendment kind of in a way that it's not actually written and not actually intended. So that's one thing. And I mean, the second thing is, well, me personally, I just don't see why. I don't see that guns have a place in society. I mean, unless you're a hunter, unless you're a hunter, I just don't see any need to have guns. That's just my personal opinion. But then, you know, since obviously points one and two, it's not going to happen in this country. I definitely think that there are things that we could do to compromise. For example, there's no reason to have assault rifles, assault weapons. I mean, any kind of like magazine that has, you know, 20-100 bullets in it. I mean, that's not for hunting, you know, that's for killing a lot of people all at once. And there's no reason to have that. So I think that should be the first step, really. It should be getting all of these semi-automatic and automatic and like multi-barrel, or what, I don't even know what all the words are for them. But, you know, these guns that are made to kill a lot of people at once, those, they need to just not be available anymore. And fine, if you feel more comfortable having a pistol or a shotgun or you're a hunter, well then fine, have those guns. But, you know, there's no reason for semi-automatic weapons. We're not in a war in theory. This isn't a war zone. So there's no need for it. And I mean, what have they done for this country except, you know, like most recently kill a lot of children. So I think that's definitely the first step. I definitely don't think that giving teachers guns is the solution, because that seems to be the big compromise that the NRA wants to make. It's that let's arm the teachers. And I don't know, that just like seems like a horror movie waiting to happen, you know?
How can someone who has never experienced the other end of a pistol understand how severe the situation is? How can someone who tends to intellectualize the problem feel it on an emotional level? Do you have any thoughts or feelings you can impart?
I mean, it's probably something that they wouldn't end up doing, but, you know, there's ways to kind of meditate on other people's pain and to think, like, put yourself, you know, as Atticus Finch said, to put yourself in another person's shoes and really put yourself in their shoes. And I think by listening to stories of survivors, that's probably one way to start, is to really think about how, you know, this gun that was just randomly on the street somewhere or that someone purchased legally, how that one gun has completely changed someone's life for the worse, you know, and then the families that are destroyed by these killings and to really sit and think of them as not just like some random stranger, but think of this as someone that you love, somebody that you know that this happened to. And try to, try to connect with it somehow in that way. But it just doesn't seem to me like the people who are such big supporters of you know, having semi-automatic weapons and all of this, it just doesn't seem like something that they would be willing to do, because then they might have to change their position. And they're clearly very, very strong about that position, you know?
Have you been able to enjoy Halloween at all in the last 12 years?
It depends. It depends. There have been a couple Halloweens where, you know, I felt okay and I had friends around and we were able to have a party. I think I've had two Halloween parties, but most of the time I always plan to do stuff. And then on the day of, I just can't. I still basically spend most of the day crying, which I know Wendy would hate that. Like, she would hate it, but there's, you know, it's just I have to do what I have to do as well in order to feel like somehow things are coming out. And it's just my body remembers that day. So even when my mind isn't thinking about it, like all of a sudden I'm very anxious and I'm like, oh, what's this? Like, why am I nervous to go to the store? Or like, why am I having a panic attack right now? Like, I'm not even, like, nothing's wrong. And it's like, oh my God, tomorrow is the 28th or next week is the 28th. It's like, and that's kind of weird too, when you're not thinking about it, you know, and you're living your life and everything is fine. And then all of a sudden, like something will happen that just triggers it. And I hate that they use that word to describe what happens to traumatized people when they see something that reminds them or brings it up. They call it a trigger. And oh, that just, you know, that triggers bad stuff. You know, just hearing people use that word with it, because obviously, you know, my story, there was a trigger and an actual trigger, and now there's triggers everywhere. So yeah. So, Halloween it's never been the same. So
5 minutes of your life involving a gun has led to 12 years of difficulty.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I mean, you know, suicide attempt and yeah, just that one night. Yeah. And like you said, 5 minutes and I'm never the same. Wendy's family, I mean, we lost an amazing person. I mean, Wendy, my God, that girl, she was going to be president of the universe, basically. I mean, that girl could do anything and she did everything. Artist, poet, writer, playwright, you know, actress, just, she was the most amazing person. And, you know, all the people who never got to meet her, all the art that she never got to make, and all that was lost in 5 minutes and over an empty wallet.
But here's what we haven't lost: an ability to understand and empathize. To understand how handguns have proliferated throughout our culture, I spoke with Paul Barrett, a senior writer at Business Week and the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. So let's talk about how the Glock 17, the first Glock gun, came into fruition. I mean, here was a gun that was using plastic parts as opposed to metal.
Right.
It was 23 ounces, fairly lightweight. It only had 34 components. Do you think that the Glock was an inevitable next stage in the evolution of guns, that if Gaston Glock had not come around, someone else would have? And what effect has the Glock 17 and its cousins and its children had on guns and American culture?
Yeah, okay. Well, those are all good questions and several. I think probably the use of industrial strength plastic, more advanced manufacturing methods, and the simplification of gun technology were all things that were going to happen. Gaston Glock was kind of the genius general contractor at the right place at the right time, and smart enough to bring together experts both in traditional firearms design and modern manufacturing to come up with this innovative design. It was significant for all the reasons you mentioned. Plastic materials were more durable, they were cheaper to manufacture, very simple, therefore not likely to break down. But there's a couple of key sort of substantive aspects of the firearm that are very significant. First and foremost, magazine capacity. The light materials and the design of the gun allowed it to hold more rounds of ammunition. And that's what really made the Glock stand out at the time that it was introduced. 17 rounds in the magazine, an 18th round if you choose in the chamber, and that compared to 5 or 6 rounds in a Smith & Wesson revolver, and that helps explain why American police forces in the late 1980s were so enthusiastic about the Glock. And sure enough, in the following decade, pretty much the entire rest of the firearm market followed Gaston Glock, as often happens. When someone makes a leap ahead with technology, the rivals at first sort of look away, try to deny that there's been a change, and then fall into line and imitate it.
I actually started to feel sorry for Smith & Wesson while reading your book, because they turned into copycat manufacturers.
That's right.
And in fact, you also expose this sort of negotiation going on between the U.S. government and Smith & Wesson for Smith & Wesson to produce safer guns with more restrictions. And this caused a great outroar when the NRA said, no, we're not going to actually purchase anything from Smith & Wesson because of these back dealings and all that.
Right. Well, those were events separated by a fair amount of time. But you're absolutely correct that Smith & Wesson, more than any other of the storied gun manufacturers, has been battered and bruised by Glock in various ways over the years. First, Glock came and ate up a big chunk of Smith & Wesson's law enforcement market. Then later in time, as you were indicating, in the late 90s and into 2000, when there was a big push to sue the gun industry by American municipalities, Glock managed to feint and avoid those suits in a much more adroit way than Smith & Wesson. And over time, Glock has been, as a result, more successful in commercial terms and certainly more influential in terms of having the rest of the handgun marketplace follow it, while Smith & Wesson has been kind of eating Glock's dust.
How does the Glock compare with the Saturday Night Special?
They're two very different items of commerce. Saturday Night Special is obviously a very loose and pejorative term, usually refers to a very inexpensive gun that would be appealing to criminals because it would be so cheap, readily available on the black market, and also, as the name might suggest, not necessarily a reliable gun or a high-functioning gun. The Glock is quite different. It is not a junk gun. It is not an inexpensive gun. It is simple in design, but if you were to analogize it to a car, it would be, you know, more like a Toyota or a Honda, an efficient, sort of consumer-oriented, durable, not super expensive, but also not cheap product, and certainly not one that has been in the real world especially identified with crime. Glocks have not been found in any disproportionate numbers at crime scenes, and that's largely because the gun is simply not that cheap. I mean, people don't lose track of them. Thieves and muggers are not going to spend the time and trouble and resources on acquiring Glocks legally when they can get a throwaway handgun on the street for $50.
A Saturday Night Special might be a disposable cell phone, and a Glock is a smartphone.
If you wish, yes, sure.
Yeah. So you point out, and this is something I really was not aware of, that Glock ingratiated itself with various police departments around the nation,
right,
by replacing the used pistols for new pistols. Did Glock do this to try to, I suppose, get in or cajole the police departments in advance? I mean, you also bring up this 1999 Today Show appearance with Paul Januzzo,
yes,
who was Glock's counsel at the time,
yes,
versus New Orleans Mayor Mark Morial.
Right.
And it made him look bad when this particular deal was exposed in New Orleans. So was there any kind of chicanery involved with doing this? Was it just a good business decision, or was there something more?
Well, I think it was actually all of the above. I mean, it was certainly a very clever gambit. It was a gambit designed to move the product. It was a marketing strategy designed to get the foot in the door so that a foreign-made product would become familiar to this huge and lucrative marketplace in the United States. It's not clear that Glock's aggressive selling of its products to police departments were necessarily terrific public policy. Many police departments seemed to get into a habit of trading their guns in quite frequently. This had the side effect of putting a lot of used police guns on the secondary market, which gun control proponents say was a bad thing because some of those guns ended up being used in crime. But, you know, it's kind of business in the great American tradition of, if there's someone out there who's going to buy, then I'll be there to sell. Glock was just very adroit at taking advantage of, you could say, exploiting marketing opportunities. And first that was with the police. And beyond that, they persuaded a lot of civilian gun owners that if it's good enough for the police, well, then it's good enough for you. And then when there were restrictions introduced, for example, on magazine capacity in the 1990s, Glock was very adroit at saying, well, first of all, we've got a pre-ban product that is still legal. And second, we've designed a new product, a smaller, more compact product that is legal under the new laws as well. So this is a hallmark of the Glock as a company, which is to say, tremendous resilience and ability to respond to changes in the marketplace and respond to regulation.
Going back to that gun control you just mentioned, in which pre-1994 manufactured assault weapons and guns with large magazines were grandfathered in, so if you actually manufactured up to a certain date,
correct,
you could actually still use the gun, and you were able to kind of have this loophole, which Glock and other gun manufacturers actually used to manufacture an enormous number of guns right before the ban kicked in.
So far as I can tell, you will not find a great deal of remorse within the Glock company, the Glock family, for the misuse of their guns. And that's common throughout the gun industry and at the NRA, the gun owners lobby. Their view of the world is that the article of commerce, the weapon, is itself not the cause of mayhem. It's the misuse of the weapon, whether by criminals or by insane people. And I don't think, even if you were to administer truth serum to Gaston Glock, that you'd find that he feels that he's done anything wrong. He's an arms maker in the tradition that goes back 600 years of making firearms, and I think he's quite proud of it.
You pointed to a number of municipal lawsuits against Glock.
Yes.
There were efforts to try to hold them accountable for rises in homicides and so forth. And then, of course, in 2005, there is this ban on civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers and,
right,
and suppliers. Do you think that Glock responded to these suits and the ban on these suits any different from any other gun manufacturer?
Yes, in a sense, I would say that Glock was among the most adroit in responding to this quite serious legal threat. Because a big part of its business is selling to law enforcement agencies at all levels, state, federal, local, Glock needed to remain on very good terms with its government clients at the same time that it was fighting the municipal lawsuits. And it managed to kind of negotiate that situation with a great deal of nimbleness, suggesting for a number of years that it might be willing to compromise, it might be willing to make certain modifications in how its guns were marketed. And then at the last minute, when the suits began to fall apart for separate legal reasons, because they were flawed in terms of their legal theory, Glock pulled back from settling, leaving, as you indicated earlier, kind of Smith and Wesson out on the thin ice, holding hands with the antagonists of the gun industry. And so Glock basically got to play it both ways. For a while, they framed themselves as being sort of a moderate company along with Smith and Wesson. The last minute, they pulled back and remained in good stead with the NRA and didn't lose business as Smith and Wesson did. All of this I would attribute to Glock's commercial imperative. I don't think much of this is ideological. I don't think much of this is driven by a moral sense. This is driven by a very hard-nosed practical strategy of how do we sell more firearms and make more money from those sales. Glock has a very close relationship at this point with the NRA. Glock makes contributions to NRA causes, and the NRA in return is friendly toward Glock, and that helps Glock's sales activities, certainly. I don't think any of this is a sort of mystery or is hard to figure out. The gun rights, gun owners lobby, the NRA, sees it as in its interest to stir constant controversy it does not want to compromise. It does not want to seem reasonable to opponents of gun ownership. It wants to seem like an ever vigilant and even ever bellicose defender of gun rights. And by doing so, it encourages its members to be similarly aggressive. It encourages its members to make donations to the cause. And it stirs the pot the way many single issue interest groups do. Their purpose in life is not to come up with grand bargains that would make their presence irrelevant. Their purpose is to keep the fight going because they are fighters. That's their role. This is something that benefits the gun industry because controversy over gun control, stirred by the NRA, in the United States, tends to cause people to go out and buy more guns. So it actually is an aspect of marketing the firearms. I refer to it frequently in writing as fear marketing. You create the fear that there will be a restriction on the availability of the product, and loyal enthusiasts of the product will go out and buy one more or two more before they become unavailable, or before they fear they will become unavailable. You know, there are many other guns that look a whole lot like the Glock, that function a lot like the Glock, but Glock was there first and therefore still has that brand recognition. Also, like Google, Glock has a role in popular culture at this point that other gun manufacturers can only dream about, because Glock was there at the beginning of the semi-automatic pistol revolution, the large capacity pistol revolution in this country, and therefore still to this very day you will see in Hollywood movies, on television, on the internet, in hip-hop music, references to Glock, images of Glock to a much greater extent than its rivals.
You draw many parallels between Gaston Glock and Samuel Colt.
Yes.
What do you think the differences are? Are there any sort of historical contexts?
Well, yes. I mean, Colt was, of greater stature in terms of being a real innovator. I mean, when Colt was introducing his revolvers, this was a period when there was not that much of a handgun market, and he helped invent the handgun market in this country to begin with. He also helped invent mass marketing via brochures and other kinds of public displays in an era before our mass market even existed. So in that sense, Colt was more of a technological innovator and a bigger figure in the history of firearm design, firearm marketing, and business in general. I would say that Gaston Glock is as much a latter-day version of Colt as you could be in a very mature market. I mean, a firearm in its basic functioning, the basic ammunition, the idea of a hammer hitting the back of a cartridge and gas being released and a bullet being propelled out of barrel, well, that basic technology is still being used. And Gaston Glock added some modern touches in terms of manufacturing techniques, in terms of simplifying the design, and he was a master marketer. But it's not like he helped invent the advertising poster, which is something Samuel Colt can actually be associated with.
How did the two of them generate demand for their weapons? Maybe that's a good way of looking at the parallels or the differences.
Oh, absolutely. Well, both of them really got national attention in the United States by having their firearms embraced by some of the leading law enforcement / military figures of their day. I mean, the Texas Rangers embracing Colt's revolver and his being able to say that on advertising posters in an era when the Texas Rangers represented the frontier and law enforcement itself and the imposition of civilization on the wilds of the West was a huge advantage for Colt in associating himself and his company and his manufacturing techniques with the modern firearm. Similarly, Glock's being able to say, well, look, the police all across the country in the space of just a few years have embraced my weapon. There must be something good and effective and impressive and even a little bit sort of cool, a little bit, glamorous was the same claim. And Glock had the advantage of the sort of the Hollywood kick, because Hollywood embraced him as well. There wasn't really an equivalent to Hollywood in the 19th century. And that gave, that allowed the Glock to be projected onto the popular culture in a really dramatically short period of time, and in a way that no product could have been introduced in the 19th century.
So with the Sandy Hook massacre,
yes,
and with a number of shootings that we've seen on New Year's Eve, there's been an increased dialogue over the need to have gun control.
Neither Glock nor other American gun manufacturers are in any peril from anything that has any chance of being enacted in the next 10 years. We are at an unusual, in global terms, an unusual pass in the United States with our gun politics. We have this pattern, which has grown pronounced in recent years, of these awful random mass shootings. But it is not at all clear to me that the specific proposals that have been made in the wake of such shootings would really have much direct effect on them at all. For example, just to give you one example, you know, if you restrict the manufacturing and sale of new semi-automatic rifles beginning on some date out in the future, later this year or next year, that's going to have no effect on the vast arsenal of such weapons that already are in private hands. Similarly, if you were to reimpose the 10-round magazine capacity restriction that existed from 1994 to 2004, which was aimed at Glock in particular, among a few other brands, there are already so many Glocks and so many large magazines out there in private hands, it's not clear to me that that would have any direct or short-term impact whatsoever. Now, I'm not actually commenting on whether it would be wise or not wise to do those things. Would those steps have some marginal effect at some point out in the future? Perhaps. Are they largely symbolic at this point? I would say yes. Are there other anti-crime measures that would be more likely to be effective? I would say yes, and be happy to explain if you'd like. In the gun control arena, we could take laws that we already have on the books, which make it a felony for a convicted felon or someone who's been adjudicated mentally ill or adjudicated addicted to drugs or an alcoholic or has even a misdemeanor protective order against them. All of those categories are not allowed to acquire or possess guns right now. And there really isn't much debate about any of that. The NRA is not actively fighting that law, and you need to go through a background check before legally acquiring a gun to make sure you don't fit into any of those categories, except if you buy the gun privately, not through a federally licensed firearm dealer, or if you use a straw purchaser. So you could take as a first step simply the rationalization of the background check system that is already in place and has been in place for 20 years to apply to all gun transactions across the board, whether they're done by federally licensed dealers or not. To me, that would be a step that, first of all, can very rationally be framed as an anti-crime measure, not something aimed at restricting lawful people from acquiring or possessing guns. Doesn't take guns away from anybody, doesn't prevent law-abiding citizens from acquiring as many guns as they want to. It stops the convicted criminal, it stops the insane person, it stops the adjudicated alcoholic from acquiring guns, and it then makes it a crime for that person to try to get the gun, and it makes it a crime to sell the gun to them. Now, that would be something I think it would be much more likely that we could build a consensus around than having these endless debates about what qualifies as an assault weapon and is an assault weapon any more or less dangerous than something that it is very similar to an assault weapon but looks a little different. That debate, in my personal view, is kind of a dead end, and I think we'd be much wiser to focus on the question of keeping guns out of the hands of criminals and other inappropriate owners than we would be in limiting the types of guns that are available on the market.
Do you think that a national gun registry might also solve this problem, where every single gun was tracked to every single owner?
I don't know. I don't think it would have any effect on psychopathic suicide mass murder situations. I don't think Adam Lanza, the shooter in Newtown, Connecticut, would have cared one way or the other whether his mother's guns which were owned legally, were also owned legally and registered. I do know that that would provoke a long, painful, politically draining fight that would end, I would predict, in there not being a gun registry, because many, many gun owners would view that as a step toward gun confiscation. And I don't think it's a fight worth having. I'm a hardcore pragmatist. I don't believe in starting political fights for purely symbolic reasons. And I also am a huge believer in identifying what you're trying to accomplish and trying to find feasible avenues toward that goal first before looking for the least likely avenues toward that goal. And that's why I'm a much bigger fan of anti-crime measures, tougher enforcement of laws that we already have and that we've already had political debates over, rather than proposed laws that we know are going to result in a kind of radioactive political explosion because they can be framed as questions of gun rights.
That concludes this week's program. Our thanks to Sazin Kohler and Paul Barrett. Tune in next week when we turn our attention to cycles. How has a best-selling Scottish novelist maintained his detective series for so long? What compelled two kids to spend their teenage years reproducing a Hollywood classic? Find out on episode 3. But until next week, we encourage you to follow your ears. You never know what little nugget you might pick up. And don't forget to visit our website at followyourears.com for all our episodes. Remember, follow your ears. Curiosity is too essential to existence to ignore. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.